You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark. It's our Christmas show this episode. So it's a show with a difference. I'm joined by broadcaster and writer Rory McGrath. We're going to be looking back on the year in books, focusing on a few in particular. We'll also revisit some of our favourite interviewees from 2018, though they were all lovely. We'll also hear from Kate Fleet from Heffers about what's expected to be flying off the shelves at Christmas time. And there's a Christmas short story from crime writer Alison Bruce. So, Rory, hello.
Hello, thank you. I now feel underdressed for the Christmas show.
Where's your woolly jumper, yes?
Well, I know I could have come as Santa if you want, or one of his elves, no.
Next year.
It's very nice to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
What's Christmas like, Shay McGrath, then?
Well, our house, we are polar opposites, me and my wife. She loves Christmas and makes it all special and magical, and she's the best present wrapper I've ever seen. And I hate it. I'm a humbug.
Really? Yes, you hate it? Why do you hate it?
I think it's been... I mean, I loved it when I was a child. When you're brought up a sort of, in a sort of Roman Catholic family, it's very special. It's very religious. And I think for Christmas to work, you either have to... I've got to be careful what I say now. I think you have to believe in God and Father Christmas for it to work. Not that I'm saying Father Christmas doesn't exist.
Yes, careful.
Or indeed God doesn't exist. How many people can we offend? I think it's not for grown-ups, really.
No.
And the commercial, it's a cliche, you know, it's commercially, you know, people start getting their Christmas decorations out in August and it's really depressing, you know.
What about gifts? Are you a good gift buyer?
I'm a good gift buyer and I buy gifts. I think I don't sort of ask people for lists. I actually think of something original to... I think the most depressing words in the English language that I can't think of any saying or any sentence that has depressed me or frightens me as much as "there's a feast of fun on BBC One this Christmas." That is, yeah.
The word fun is, yes. I mean, I remember in a previous life working as a press officer and I had to put a statement out from Matthew Kelly, who was patron of a charity I was working for.
Yes, Matthew, yes.
And I'd drafted a statement for him, which is, you know, we're going to have lots of fun. And I spoke to him on the phone. He said, the rest of the statement's fine, but take out fun. He said, it's just one of those words, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We don't want fun and Christmas.
You're hostage to fortune. What does it mean? Yeah, so, I'm with you there.
And, of course, there's the Christmas Strictly special, of course.
Are you a Strictly fan?
No, I'm a Strictly widower. Is that right?
Ah, okay.
Yes.
So you can plan your day around...
I can't. It's not the same since Len Goodman left in my book.
Oh, controversial. That's two controversial things you said in the first couple of minutes.
Here's another thing. Thank you for having me on the show. I want to know who dropped out at the last minute.
No one. You were always our first choice.
Bless you.
Well, we're going to play two Christmas tracks in this show. We'll start with the Pogues and Kirsty MacColl's Fairy Tale of New York, because it's one of your favourites. Did you meet Kirsty?
Kirsty, I mean, I get very emotional talking about Kirsty MacColl because of her tragic death. That's one thing. But I met her in the sort of early 90s when I was putting together a country western band to take to the Edinburgh Festival, and we needed a female singer to front the band. And I was talking to this guy, a record producer whom I vaguely knew, called Stephen Lewhite. And it's late at night in a club in London. And he said, "Oh, my wife's a singer." And I said, "Oh, right. What does she do?" He said, "Oh, she can do anything." I said, "All right, what's her name?" He said, "Kirsty." I said, "Oh, Kirsty, that's a nice name." I said, "Wait, she's coming in a minute. So she's meeting me here. So why?" And this girl came in who I didn't recognise as Kirsty MacColl. And she was ever so sort of really down to earth and great fun to be with. And I was chatting to her. I said, "Kirsty, you're a singer." I said, "That's right, yeah." I said, "I want someone to front my band, but it's comedy and country and western. Do you think you can handle that?" She said, "Yeah, I think so." I said, "What sort of experience have you had singing?" She said, "I've had a number one." And then suddenly I sort of put two and two together. Oh, of course.
That Kirsty.
There's a guy who works down the chip shop, thinks he's Elvis.
And did she ever? Did she ever?
No, she didn't. My musical director, Philip Pope, he said, "We can't afford Kirsty MacColl."
Well, here she is, the late, great Kirsty.
septic tank. An old man said to me, won't see another one. And then he sang a song, the rare old mountain tune. I turned my face away and dreamed about you. Got on a lucky one, came in 18 to 1. I've got a feeling this year.
Fairy Tale of New York, of course, The Pogues and Kirsty MacColl. The first choice of Christmas music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Rory McGrath, a writer and comedian. His memoirs, Bearded Tit and The Father, The Son and The Ghostly Hole, received critical acclaim. He's also written scripts for Frankie Howard, Not the 9 o'clock News, Alas, Smith and Jones and Who Dares Wins. So obviously your comedy scripts you wrote,
yeah,
Rory, are fiction. You've got your memoirs. Have you ever thought about writing a novel?
I'm in the middle of writing a sort of, I started last year and I stopped writing after about four chapters. It's a sort of gothic fantasy, science fiction, sort of magical thing.
Touching all bases then.
Well,
appealing to a very broad spectrum of readers.
It's supposed to be funny. It's a comic novel and it's sort of parodic, but I don't want it just to be a parody of fantasy novels or science fiction and stuff. It's supposed to stand up in its own right.
Okay, well, watch this space then.
Yeah.
Excellent. And has there been a standout novel of the year for you that you've read?
For me, and now this is a first for me this year, I've actually read the Booker Prize winner.
Anna Burns,
in the same year, and I love that.
Excellent. Well, we'll come on to Milkman by Anna Burns. Let's look at another novel that's had a pretty good year, which is Eleanor Oliphant's Completely Fine. It won the Costa First Novel Award, longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. I know you've read it, Rory, because I asked you to. Would you have read it if I hadn't have asked you?
Six of the novels that I've read this year I've done for you, Lee. You realise that I've read more this year than I've read the rest of my life.
Well, good. I'll take responsibility.
I loved Gail Hunman's book, Eleanor Oliphant. I thought it was a wonderful... She's a wonderful character, and you get Eleanor and all her sort of quirky characteristics very, very quickly in the book, which I liked, and, you know, I really liked it. I think if I have a... And it made me laugh a lot, and I found it very, very touching. If I have a complaint about it now, I've got to be very careful here, because I risk... I know what the young people call spoiler alerts here.
Yes.
I thought the way she handled one aspect of the plot to do with her mother could have been done more dramatically and more cleverly exposed. Does that make sense
it
to
does.
You without giving it away?
It does. I kind of agree. I second guess the twist, if you like. But I'm not sure it was meant to be that much of a twist. I didn't mind second guessing it.
I didn't guess early on because I'm as clever as you. But I was sort of disappointed. You know, it was sort of thrown away, and I felt that as a shame.
Yes, but that's in a way I quite liked that, because I think it was only one element of the story.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, either it's going to be a massive twist that astonishes you, or if you've guessed it, then
I suppose I can say it didn't spoil the book for me. I loved it, and it's rare for me to finish a book and be upset that I finished it. Normally, I finish a book and say, "Thank God I finished that book." And this was I missed it. You know,
I loved it. I absolutely loved it, and it's laugh out loud.
It is
funny, is it? And humorous writing is quite difficult.
It is.
And the central character, as you say, very quirky, very odd, but she depicts her so well. You've got her in the first three
pages. Also,
it's
set. I get fed up with you know, things being set in London, and so I quite like that it was Glaswegian, and it gave a very good sense of you know, Glasgow and what it was like, you know, suburban Glasgow. I liked it a lot.
And I thought that, I mean, spoiler alert again, although I'm not going to give much away, but the last page is the most exquisitely written piece.
It is very beautifully written.
Balanced piece of, moved me to tears, really. And yet, on the face of it, it's not an emotional scene, but that you know there's so much going on.
It was very moving, actually. You're right. I mean, I do cry easily. I managed to get through the Pogues and Kirsty MacColl without crying, which is...
Well done. Your second choice of music, you may not,
I did find it very moving. And I, as you say, I think what was nice about it is that I was able to find the last bit moving on top of the fact it was laugh out loud all the way through, you know.
Another one of these books that has at its core, a bit like The Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime or The Rosie Project, a character who's sort of slightly, well, not slightly, sort of on the edge of society,
exactly.
Really. Doesn't quite get it, hasn't got the normal in inverted
No, I like that
behavior.
A lot. I mean, you know, there's a lot of us on the edge of society. You know, it's very crowded there. In fact, the interesting thing, I don't know if you remember this, but when we were talking about what books I should read, you know, and you mentioned three books, all by women, and I said, what a lot of women's authors are. And it occurred to me that I haven't read a novel by a man for about 3 years. And when I made a list of everything I'd read recently, they're all women.
Well, all the award winners are women at the moment. Yeah, women's fiction is really going through a great phase, I think. This has been optioned as a film, Eleanor Oliphant. It's completely fine.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll ruin it.
Well, it's Reese Witherspoon has optioned it. I don't know whether she'll be it herself. All the way through, I was trying to picture Eleanor Oliphant. And I,
really?
As a, you know, which actress would play
Miranda
her.
Hart, I thought.
Did you? Mm. I had I've forgotten her name, but the actress who plays Amy in The Big Bang Theory. But that's not quite right either.
No.
But I was trying to physically get a hold on her.
I want it not to be Americanized, basically. You frightened me already, now I'm worried.
Yeah, I know, because there is something very British about it.
Absolutely.
Well, that was Eleanor Oliphant. It's completely fine. I thoroughly recommend that, as does Roy.
I do as well.
And that's published by HarperCollins. Another debut novel that's done well this year is We That Are Young by Preeti Taneja. She's a local author. And this book has won the Desmond Elliott Prize. It's been shortlisted for the Republic of Consciousness Prize. It explores issues of family, violence, the position of women in India. It's a rewriting of King Lear, and we talked to Preeti about this earlier in the year on Bookmark, and this is what she had to say.
King Lear offers you the chance to just go to town with that kind of violence, unfortunately, and it's as if Shakespeare was trying to say something. King Lear's often portrayed as this sort of tragic, heroic figure, but he's absolutely awful to his daughters, and he is deeply scared of feminine power. He's deeply, as a character, threatened by these two older daughters who want to take each other by the hand and stand together. I mean, that is so powerful as women for us to do. So, you know, you can really, as a writer, look at the ways in which he uses his curses and his language and his appeals to gods and the ways in which he talks about the female body. And all of those things are in the text that I've written in We That Are Young. I do adhere quite strongly to Shakespeare's own language. It's in the sentences.
And in the rhythms.
Yeah.
But is it a problem that people know the ending of King Lear?
Lots of people don't, actually. because the book has this wide reach between India and Shakespeare, you know, and Shakespeare is often done in different countries and in different cultures in different ways. The ending of Lear, I don't think it does. I don't know. Some people say, oh, yeah, we know the ending, but they're more interested in how you're going to get there then. So it's a different kind of puzzle for them. And if you don't know the ending, you're just going to have a massive heartbreaking shock, I think.
Yeah,
I hope.
Yeah. And your ending is slightly different as well.
It is slightly different. I think I make some of the gaps in Lear a bit more explicit. There's always stuff about the play that's troubled me. And I wanted to go to those parts of it too.
That was Preeti Taneja talking on Bookmark earlier this year about her novel We That Are Young, published by Galley Beggar Press. It's an extraordinary book, I thought, Rory, very different to the Gail Honeyman book.
It is, yes, that's true. And I read them in that order, so it was a shock to me after that. To be honest, I wanted to like this book a lot because, you know, I know she's a Jesus College girl, and I like the idea of transposing the King Lear story into a sort of a millionaire Indian businessman's life. But I found it rather, I don't know. Well, I'll do the positives first. I thought it, some of the writing was brilliant evocation of India at the sort of decadent, luxurious top and the sort of abject poverty. I mean, she covered, it was riveting. Both extremes of that society felt very real.
There's that long section in the middle which is set on a kind of waste, a dump, which a luxury hotel backs onto, and that's really vivid.
I mean, the strange thing, I did a programme once set in the Taj Mumbai, one of the luxury hotels in Bombay, as I like to call it. And you do leave the back door and you are in squalor, not quite a landfill site, but the squalor is just there, 6 inches away from absolute, you know, total luxury and decadence. So I love that about it. And also I thought some of her style, when it was poetic, was beautiful, really, really lovely. It's fantastic passages of sort of poetic writing. But...
It's all right, that's a fire alarm. That's happens every time we record, it's all right.
I just sit here and burn, don't worry. I thought it was too long. And I don't normally mind long books, but I noticed this and I found it towards the end, it got a bit sort of repetitive and messy, and you thought, actually, this book could have ended already. And I then started getting annoyed with it because I think it's still going on. It seemed to drag out because there are five separate stories, you know, which is okay. There's obviously going to be some structural repetition because you're seeing one story from five different points of view. But I just found it a bit tedious. And I said, oh, I've read this bit already, you know, haven't I read this bit already? And I ended up thinking, I want this book to finish now. So
it's a very ambitious book, isn't it? Because it spans many different countries, many different generations, covers all those issues, and, as she says, encompasses the idea of Lear.
Sorry to interrupt you. I was thinking the King Lear thing. I mean, it's clearly, you know, a very rich, powerful man says to his three daughters, you know, how much do you love me? And I'll divide the kingdom up according to what you say. That is, you know, the sort of bare bones of Lear. But actually, I didn't think the Lear story particularly impinged that much. If I hadn't read Lear, it probably wouldn't have, I wouldn't have said, though, this is a rewrite of Shakespeare in modern India. That didn't bother me at all. So it was slightly different in plot. I did King Lear for A-level. And I read it as well, so that's a double surprise.
It's amazing how these A-level texts stay with you.
Yeah, and so I was familiar with it, but that didn't impinge. I didn't think, oh, this is ripped off from King Lear, or this isn't King Lear, or this is King Lear. That didn't bother me so much, so I'm surprised people sort of mention that so much. I just felt it was a shame, because I enjoyed so much, as I said, of the actual writing, you know, words on paper, as I call writing. I just found it got a bit sloppy and messy towards the end, and it could have been because of constructed in a sort of more sort of climactic way.
I quite liked the grandness of the scale. I mean, I take your point that maybe it's a little long, which may be a fault of a debut novel, I guess, and somebody getting very involved in their world. But the writing, as you say, the descriptions of life in India, I've never been to India, but I felt like I was there. The smells, the colours, the way she brings that along.
Everything, you know, the food, the different spices, the colours, what they wear. I mean, it's wonderfully done, which is why I feel a bit sort of peevish about having to sort of not like it, you know, as much as we're always going to disagree, aren't we?
Well, disagreeing is fine. I mean, there's violence in it as well, which is
there's graphic violence
shocking.
And graphic sex, which is handled very well. I think I didn't feel it was gratuitously graphic in any way. You know, like some books you think, actually, this, you know, like the Millennium Trilogy, for example, is full of sexual violence, and I just find it tedious and rather overdone. But this felt very, very real. The love, the sex and the violence felt extremely physical, very real and sort of tangible.
Yes, I mean, truly an epic book. So that is We That Are Young by Preeti Taneja by Galley Beggar Press. Well, normally at this point on a bookmark, we have a reading from our studio guest, Rory, but don't panic. Somebody else has stepped up to the mark. We'll hear a Christmas crime short story now from Alison Bruce. Alison is well known for her crime novels, particularly the Gary Goodhue series and the trademark Cambridge setting. She's also been shortlisted twice for the Crime Writers Association Dagger in the Library Award. So enjoy this, her short story called Shard of Glass.
My uncle Brian has a scar above his left eye. It runs for an inch and a half in a parallel line close to his eyebrow. It is difficult to see unless you know it's there, but when I was a child it was prominent, an ugly welt that never seemed to heal. Uncle Brian had been sitting in the passenger seat when the windscreen had crashed in on him, and in the next few seconds of shouting and banging and blood, the monthly payroll had been stolen. They stitched him up. The men were caught, and a more subdued Uncle Brian carried on much as before. Everything settled apart from that ridge of scar above his eye. It continued to hurt for several years, and he would press the tender spot with his finger, until one day a tiny splinter of glass broke through the skin. It was only then that it finally healed. Cambridge is my shard of glass. I thought I'd never return, and I don't want to be here, but for the last 36 hours, my thoughts have been nowhere else. It is the 6th of December, the 5th anniversary, and like before, it's a Thursday. As soon as the train pulled in, I knew that things had changed. New apartment blocks had appeared along with the extra platforms, and that meant extra trains and extra people and extra energy. I had forgotten the way that Cambridge always seemed to be surging, and I followed that surge along Hills Road and into town. It was the route I'd walked countless times in the past, but when I saw the start of Regent Street, my heart began to pound and the first frames of the TV reconstruction replayed in my head. I made it as far as I could, and then took refuge in the nearest coffee shop, where I ordered tea and watched the condensation on the window until I felt calm again. That's where I am now, sitting at the window and watching the damp glass. It reminds me of going home to my parents' house, to opening the front door and being met by the steam and smell of cooking that had rolled up the hallway from the kitchen. That's how it was at Christmas each year, and Mum and Dad would be at the door to greet us before we'd had time to remove our coats. And she'd usher us through to the too warm lounge and feed us on homemade cake. The first small groups pass. They walk quickly, underdressed in thin clothes and not yet warm from alcohol and banter. 5 years ago, I remember shivering, my dress short enough to make me feel self-conscious. I remember tugging at the hem each time I stood up or walked up or down any steps. And I hear the voiceover on that reconstruction. He uses the word catastrophic. I don't want to remember much after that, but I know I must try. I wait until 9 p.m. and then leave. Outside it is dark and white Christmas lights stand out like pinpricks. There'd been the four of us. Me and my brother Josh and his flatmates, Bailey and Claire. They'd started with pre-drinks and teased me because I'd never heard the phrase. I pass Pizza Express, the Regal and Castle Bar. It's the incidental things that come back to me. I remember a bicycle tyre hanging from a lamppost and a red jumper on a featureless mannequin in the window of John Lewis. Bailey wanted to find a club. Claire had lost an earring and it had started to rain. I borrowed Bailey's jacket, and Josh and Claire walked behind. Claire and I weren't dressed like the boys. We'd skipped wearing coats and gloves and complained about the cold, but we kept walking and took the fork in the road into Hobson Street. I turn into Hobson Street and see that it hasn't changed. The owners of the old cinema are still inviting offers. I look at the music shop and remember the ukulele display that hung in the window and Claire taking Bailey's coat from me. She draped it around her shoulders, then walked backwards as she teased him. Come and get it then. And Josh's resigned smile as he realised that he was only going to have me for company after all. Josh was 19 then, 2 years younger than me and struggling with his second year of studying English literature. We fell into step behind the other two and said nothing until Claire slipped her hand through Bailey's arm and they both laughed. The buildings in Sussex Street follow a gentle curve, and when it is a still night, sounds echo through here. Claire and Bailey's laughter echoed. And that's the last I could remember before I felt someone's thumb pull my eyelid and the torchlight flooded my eye. Poppy, can you hear me? and I was on the ground by the Visit Cambridge Centre on Pease Hill, with my body heat slipping away into the wet pavement, and the illuminated Christmas displays in the nearby windows blurred and overlapping like fragments in a kaleidoscope. "Where's Josh?" I whispered. "He's fine." The voice was female and belonged to a paramedic. "My colleague's with him." "Is he hurt?" I asked. And remembered the fear that hit me, of going home and telling Mum and Dad that Josh wouldn't be coming. I am walking towards that spot now, around the perimeter of the market and in front of the solemn face of the Guildhall, and I understand that fear. I stand at the corner of Pease Hill. Somewhere here is the spot where I lay bleeding. Over there is the place where he all but died. The reconstruction showed the close-up of the broken bottle, then a shot of dark oiliness glistening on the pavement, not blood, but I could see that's what it was meant to represent, enough blood loss to kill the brain. The catastrophic damage. And I see nothing new. No epiphany comes by being here, just the recognition that I needed to come, and that when I leave again I hope that it will be forever. I switch on my phone and rejoin the world. A long time ago, I transferred a phone number from a dog-eared business card into the address book. I didn't think I would use it, but I'm calling it now. "DC Goodhue?" I ask. "Speaking." "This is Poppy Brown. I'm in Cambridge. Would you meet me?" "Now?" He sounds surprised, and I check my watch to find that it's almost 10:30. Then he tells me to wait, so I stay where I am and watch this year's crop of Christmas revellers until I see him hurrying towards me along Petit Curie. "Is everything okay?" he asks, and even by the stark streetlight I can see that his green eyes are bright with concern. "I felt I had to come back," I tell him. "Is this the first time?" I nod. "Do you want to stay here or go inside somewhere?" "A drink?" I ask. "Coffee or tea, I mean." He takes me to a pub in any case, the pint shop, and we sit by the window, each with a cup of tea. 5 years ago, there had been a lot of questions from several different detectives. Funnily enough, Goodhue had been the one I'd spoken to the least. He's slim but strong, and suddenly he reminds me of Josh. He starts talking. "Are you here because it's the anniversary?" "Kind of," I admit. "I saw the reconstruction on the TV and I needed to come." "Did anyone warn you it would be on?" "No, I didn't expect them to, but it shook me up. It was more vivid than the bits I can remember." "And how have you been?" I turn my hands palm upwards on the table so he can see the scars from the broken bottle, ugly welts like Uncle Brian's. They are deeper on my right hand. "These were the worst injuries," I tell him, "and I've adapted." "And Josh?" "His injuries were superficial." "He's okay." I try to smile with the hope that it will give me confidence, but my throat tightens and tears threaten. "Have you remembered anything else?" Goodhue asks, and there's something in his manner that makes me want to tell the truth, and it stops me backing away. I shake my head. "I walked the same route tonight to see how much came back to me. But I can't remember the minutes before." The consultant says that can happen with head injuries, and that I probably won't ever remember more. I chew my lip, but there is no point in delaying what I need to say. "It was Josh who glassed Liam Miller." Goodhue isn't surprised and just nods slowly. "We could never prove it." "It blew up from nothing. Josh was already drunk and angry when Liam Miller came at him." Goodhue frowns. "I thought you couldn't remember." "Josh told me afterwards. He said it should have been self-defense, except when he started lashing out, he couldn't stop." Liam suffered severe blood loss, catastrophic brain damage. "It was so out of character. Josh has never been violent." "And then you fought him for the bottle?" he asks. I don't reply, just nod. "Poppy, does he know you're here?" "No, I haven't told him." Josh will be arrested, and I'm sure I will be too. Perverting the course of justice or assisting an offender seems most likely. I fight that lump in my throat, but I can't stop the tears running freely onto my cheeks. But I'm not crying for Liam or Josh or even for myself. I'm crying for Liam's family and our own parents and the hallways that will stand empty this Christmas.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Yes, it's Christmas edition of Bookmark. You heard Shard of Glass there by Alison Bruce, which was read by Lana Bruce. And studio guest on this issue of Bookmark is Rory McGrath. Alison, very well known, Rory,
as
a crime writer. Are you a fan of crime fiction?
I'm a big fan of crime fiction. I'm also a big fan of short stories. In fact, I was thinking, that was quite a gruesome story, wasn't it? I mean, we've had that and the Pogues. We haven't really got into sort of big festive. Where are the party poppers? And the Prosecco.
That's in another studio.
I love crime fiction. I'll tell you why. My mother, God rest her soul, was an avid reader. She read very quickly and she was obsessed with crime fiction. So our house is full of Len Dayton and Dick Francis and, you know, P.D. James, Ruth Rendell.
The kind of classic crime fiction.
Absolutely, yes. And I remember one particular long summer holiday when being in Cornwall and it was a miserable weather outside. So I think I read 12 Dick Francis novels in a row.
Wow.
And you know that he wrote, I don't know, do you know Dick Francis wrote mainly about horse racing?
Yes,
and it was quite, but it got me into it. I mean, I always like, I've recently read a lot of Ian Rankin's books, Inspector Rebus, which I believe has been televised, but I do like it. I liked the Raymond Chandler. I like as a writer, and he did sort of crime fiction, but his style is it quite inspired me. He's a good one-liner writer, Raymond Chandler, and from him, Dashiell Hammett and Mickey Spillane. I like all these, sort of, as you say, classic American. And more recently, James Ellroy, L.A. Confidential, which is an excellent book.
I've read a lot for this show. It wouldn't be a genre, in all honesty, that I would normally read, but I've read a lot for this show and really come to enjoy it quite a lot because there's lots of crime writers in Cambridge. It seems to be quite a hub for crime writing.
Yeah, well, it's a notoriously criminal place.
Possibly.
It's like Baltimore.
I mean, I'm always in awe of the plotting with crime writing.
Yeah, I do like it. I mean, and now we have to talk, I'm afraid, whether you like it or not, about Agatha Christie, who annoys me because her plots mainly depend on the character who perpetrated the crime not having appeared in the novel previously.
Yes, and she brings in right at the last minute some piece of information that you couldn't possibly
I find that
as a reader. But I consumed Agatha Christie novels
I have read a lot, yeah.
Well, let's hear about plotting now from one of our Bookmark guests, Jim Kelly, who came in to talk about The Great Darkness, which is set in Cambridge. And he told me how his wife devised a way to help him plot his novels.
She painted the office of the wall of my office with blackboard paint. So I have a huge blackboard on which I can draw the plot. Another way is to use report cards for each chapter and to put them all over the floor so that I can see the whole book at the same time. That's the trick with plotting, that you've got to see the whole thing in one go to see actually how it works. And that's actually a really difficult thing to do, and I need to externalise it. I've got several very large sketchbooks, and so I'll just draw the plot in kind of circles and sort of diagrams and stuff and just try and get the mechanics of it to kind of work on the page. It's a bit like drawing the mechanism for a clock or something. You know, it's got to work. But if you rely on trying to work out if it's working by going through the book, that's serial. The book is a straight line and the plot isn't serial in reality. It's only represented by the straight line in the book. So it's a tricky thing to do. And it's quite tiring as well, plotting, because it's like... it's like knitting with abstract things, if I can put it like that. You know, so first of all, you've got to concentrate on the abstract things, and then you've got to start manipulating them.
And The Great Darkness by Jim Kelly is published by Alison and Busby. Rory McGrath, you have written a memoir. I mean, in a way, you have to plot a memoir. Don't you have to plot the narrative?
Well, yeah,
of the
I mean, my two books were largely memoirs. The second book filled in either side of the first book, I think. But I think the problem with memoir is knowing what to leave out, because it is very tempting to put in everything, you know. And so what happens is that the storyline becomes necessarily streamlined because it's more accessible to the reader. Because you know, whatever you've done in your life, be it, you know, interesting, exciting, or dull, it's quite complicated, and there's a lot happens in a life, you know. And my problem was trying to decide what to leave out, not what to put in, you know?
And I suppose ostensibly, while it's your story, it's not, it's other people's stories as well, and,
exactly,
and you are talking about them and their lives.
And I like meeting, I like other people, and I like drawing characters, and you know, and fortunately I've, you know, I meet people who are larger than life characters, and they're easy to write about. One thing I would say about, interestingly enough, between the two books that I wrote, and there's only a gap of about 2 years, maybe 3 years, three years maximum between the two books, was what I noticed changed was the law about what you could write and what you could say about other people had changed. When the solicitor that read the proofs for the second book read out of interest the first book, he said, "How did you get away with saying all this about really? These real people?"
Well, that leads me nicely, actually. I'm going to ask you a question about what reaction you had to the publication of your memoirs. But we'll hear first from Miranda Doyle. Her book, Book of Untruths, which is published by Faber and Faber, is a memoir told through a series of lies that she was told as she was growing up. And when she came into the studio to talk about it, I asked her if the publication of the book had affected or changed her relationships with people.
I think actually what's been most profound is my relationship with friends, who I'd kept since I was a child. They're over. And they were characters in the book, and I thought I had been very kind about them. But I think in a sense, perhaps people feel used. And so it had a profound effect on many, many relationships, actually, yes.
This book has changed your life, really, hasn't it? I mean, it really has changed your relationships with people.
Yes, yes. And my husband is in it as a character as well. He's been very, very kind. And the piece of music at the end is really about meeting him. And of course, I managed to snare him through lies. No one else would have me.
They come in handy now and again.
So some people have been much more generous, but I think a lot of people understandably just feel that I've taken their lives and used them for myself, maybe.
And do you think you have?
That wasn't my intention. That wasn't my intention. But I guess it's like listening to yourself on an answering machine message, that you sound very dislocated from what you think you sound like. And maybe people have read this and thought, really? That's not me. She's misrepresented who I thought I was.
If you could go back and do it again, would you do it any differently?
I think I wouldn't do it because I don't think I could have done it any differently, I feel. Yeah. I mean, what's been most amazing is how kind people who don't know me have been about the book. That they felt it was very readable, and that's been the most amazing thing to me.
That's Miranda Doyle there. So, quite a profound effect, as we heard, the publication of her memoir. What about you, Rory? Did you feel you used anyone? Have your relationships changed? Because you are very candid in your memoirs.
The first one, as I said, was written with almost no legal interference whatsoever. The second one, I had to send anyone who's a real person mentioned or described, I had to send the actual chapter or page or sentence to them for their approval. And given that there's about sort of 50 different real life people in it. That was a very tedious job I had to, which I ended up having to pay half, because the publisher pays half for legal advice and the author pays half. So that was, that ate into my fee. And most people wrote back and said, well, the notable ones, my ex-wife, Mary, whom I'd written rather kindly about, actually, and I thought she'd be very impressed. I thought she'd say, oh, actually, that's much better than I remember. But she said, no, absolutely no way, over my dead body, can you write, have this in a book? Similarly, the people I worked with at Hattrick, who'd sacked me in mysterious circumstances, I wrote kindly about them and they wouldn't give permission. One notable exception was an ex-girlfriend of mine called Judith, who left me for the man she eventually married and has four children with, and we get on really well. And it was a particularly long chapter because it was it's a very complicated story. And I sent her this and she read it. And, of course, her husband had to read it as well. And she wrote back saying, yeah, that's fine. It was funny because I'd written it from my... I've written it with me as the sort of the baddie in it. So, I'm the loser in it, in all senses. So she said it was funny and it was a good read. And it was like a short story in itself. It's the longest chapter in the book. And her husband said, yeah, that's exactly how I remember it. And she said to me, I'm really sorry I treated you so badly. Looking back, I was awful to you, wasn't I? And she said that this is what, 20 years later, you know.
Oh, well, that's a nice outcome as opposed to Miranda's. Are you a fan of memoir, reading memoir? Do you have a favourite?
Not really. I mean, for reasons that I've outlined, it, they make me a bit nervous when I read other people writing about real people, you see. And something that Miranda says, which is interesting, is that a lot of people approach you and say, I'm not like that. You know, that what bit you wrote about me, that's that. Well, they dispute the facts of what happened, which is, memory is vague, and they dispute the fact that that's... But what they don't understand is that how they come across to you is different from how they, you know... I mean, it's the same with me, you know, because I'm always surprised that people have their prejudices about me before they've met me, you know. But you do, I see people and write about them as I see them, not as they see themselves, so...
Well, memoir, big seller at Christmas, of course, which leads me nicely into an interview, a quick interview with Kate Fleet, the events marketing manager of Heffer's Bookshop. I called in yesterday and asked her what she thought would be the Christmas bestsellers at Heffer's.
Well, we think that the Stephen Hawking Brief Answers to the Big Questions will carry on selling well. And the other book that's started to do really well around this time of year is the Ordnance Survey Quiz Book. People seem really excited by that one. And it's doing very well.
They seem very Cambridge choices. Do you think Cambridge Heffer's buyers have a particular slant?
Yes, I suspect if you asked a different shop what their bestsellers are, probably they would be different to us in several ways, yeah.
And what about Heffer staff here? What about bookshop staff? Are there any books that they're particularly keen on?
Yes, there's a book called Little by Edward Carey, which half the staff here have read. Everyone who has loved it, and that's one that everybody's really getting behind. A really, really lovely story.
And what about you? Is there a book that's not on there that you think people should be buying?
I think that it's not a new book, it came out last year, but there's a book called Mr. Dickens and His Carol, which is not the same as the film. It's a really lovely, cosy Christmas read, which I really enjoyed. There's also the Big Book of Christmas Mysteries, which would be another one to curl up with this Christmas. The Blue Peter annual of Here's One I Made Earlier is a really good one for nostalgia. And then, of course, there's games as well. I've heard that Gloomhaven is one which should be recommended. So if anyone's interested in games, do come and have a chat with our staff down in the games department. They've got some great things to recommend down there.
And what about next year? Is it too early to say what you think will be the big hitters next year?
I don't know about big hitters, but I can tell you what I've enjoyed reading in my advanced copies. There's Once Upon a River by Diana Setterfield, who also wrote The 13th Chime. It's an absolutely wonderful tale set on the Thames. There's The Familiars by Stacey Halls, which I really enjoyed as well, set around Pendle and the witches there. There's this non-fiction title that I've actually got here called The Daughters of Chivalry by Kelsey Wilson Lee, who's actually a Cambridge author, and that's about the forgotten children of Edward I. And then what I'm currently reading, which is also out in the new year, is Blackberry and Wild Rose by Sonia Velan, which I'm really enjoying that too.
What a nice job you have. You get to read all these advanced copies.
I know. I make myself sick sometimes.
And what about events? Have you got any exciting events coming up in the next couple of months or so?
Yeah, we do. So on the 6th of December, we've got Murder Under the Mistletoe, which is our annual shindig. We've got 13 crime authors coming along to read from their books, and everybody has a great time having possibly a cocktail, a chat about books, getting things signed. It's a really fun evening. And the other one that we have is an evening with Alison Weir, the historian, and Siobhan Clark, talking about the Tudors and their idea of Christmas and the traditions that have carried on until now from those days. And that is on the 5th of December, which is the day before the Murder Under the Mistletoe.
And I know you get to read a lot of books, as we've said, but is there a book that you'd like in your Christmas stocking that you haven't read yet?
There is. I spotted it the other day up on the gallery. It's The House of Ghosts by W.C. Ryan. It's bound in a beautiful black and gold cover. It's set in an old mansion. I love a good ghost story, so that if nobody else is planning to get that for me, I will be buying that for myself for sure.
That's Kate Fleet from Heffers there. And to find out about all the events taking place at Heffers Bookshop, it's heffers.co.uk/events. We're almost at the end of the show, Rory, but we have to talk, because you've read it, about the book that won the Booker Prize, Milkman by Anna Burns.
Indeed. I just made note of the Ordnance Survey quiz book. It has to go on my Christmas list straight away. Definitely. Milkman by Anna Burns. Yeah, I thought it was wonderful. I mean, it made me laugh continuously throughout. And it's it's quite a serious book. It's set in the Troubles, Northern Ireland. And I just thought it was the voice that she gives this character is just sensational. And I just thought it was. And what I like, when I was married to a girl from Belfast, my first wife, and we spent a lot of time in Northern Ireland, in Belfast and up on the Antrim coast during it was early 80s. So, you know, British soldiers were still hanging around Marks and Spencer's with their machine guns. So, and there was that, you know, you were always worried about where you parked your car in case, you know, someone put a bomb under it. And there was that tension. And what I remember is the Northern Irish people from either side of their divide were fun. It's the funnest place. They were always up for crack and it very funny, you know. And it was wonderful, you know. You'd have to go through checkpoints and barbed wire and be searched, but they were still. And there's a certain sort of Northern Irish woman who, when they talk, you think they're never ever going to pause for breath. And what I thought about this book, it's like someone talking, you know, I tell you something, this girl come on here, and it was like, and she's never going to stop. And somebody else, I mean, it reads to me like one sentence. I mean, it's very hard to stop reading it because there are sort of seven big chapters, but it's continuous. You think, I can't stop here because I'll never find my way back into it, because it just sounds like one continuous voice with sort of, you know, with sort of sidesteps and, you know, and extrapolations here and there. And I loved it.
It's very pacey, isn't it? I mean, I sort of see it as a historical document, really. It's set in an unnamed city. I mean, we assume it is Belfast. But some of the things that she writes about and passes on in conversation are presumably things that happened at some time in the Troubles, and quite shocking. I mean, I won't give spoilers away, but there's a whole bit about what happened to the dogs in one part of the city, is really upsetting, and various other things that she pulls out in the course of this conversation that she's having with the reader.
But she keeps this detached, quite humorous voice. Oh, that's just the Troubles, that's just the renouncers, you know. And I know the bit about the cat's head that she wants to bury, you know, and it's very funny.
Challenging, because as you say, it's almost like one continuous stream of consciousness, and sometimes there are pages and pages without paragraph breaks.
Exactly. And I've heard that people find it, I've read three quite rude or harsh criticisms of it, reviews of it, and saying it's impossible to read, it's impenetrable. I just didn't find that at all. I just found it was light and dark.
Well, good. Let's end on that. That's Milkman by Anna Burns, published by Faber and Faber. The next show, which is our first of 2019, the studio guest is Geeta Lodge. She'll be talking about her forthcoming crime thriller, She Lies in Wait. We'll also hear from Damien Labat. He'll be chatting about his book, The Stopping Places, A Journey Through Gypsy Britain. And Harry Sidebottom will be talking about his latest novel set in ancient Rome, The Last Hour. So it just remains for us to say Happy Christmas. Happy New Year. Lovely to have you here, Rory.
A pleasure.
And we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Enya, Anno Come, Come Emmanuel.
Oh, lovely. I'm going to cry now.
To free your captive.